You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, Orioles edition. MLB.com's Mark Feinsand recently sat down with Orioles Executive Vice President of Baseball Operations Dan Duquette. They discussed his expectations for the Birds in 2017, whether his Expos could have beaten Buck Showalter's Yankees in 1994, and how Amherst College has produced so many general managers. Here's Mark.
So how'd you land your first job in baseball?
Well, let's see. I was a student at Amherst College, and I went to this career seminar, and I remember the speaker said, well, you're going to end up spending about between 40 and 50 years of your life on the job working, so you better find out something that you like. And I said, okay, well, I kind of like sports. And I went back the next day to the career counseling office. I said, do you have any alumni that are in baseball from Amherst? And they looked it up, and they found Danny Galbraith, who was a 1950 graduate. His family owned the Pittsburgh Pirates. John Henry Galbraith was his dad. His family owned the Pirates. And then they said, oh, there's another guy here from the same class of Danny Galbraith, 1950, a guy by the name of Harry Dalton. He's the general manager of the Brewers. I said, that's good. And then
that's the one.
Yeah, right, that's perfect. And then Bob Brown was 1953 Amherst grad, and he was the PR director for the Orioles. So she said, why don't you get your resume together and send it to those guys? That'd be a good place to start. So that's what I did. And Danny Galbraith said, oh, that's great. You know, why don't you go and interview with the commissioner's office? You got a executive development program. They hire two interns there every year. He goes, I'll put you in touch with Frank Cash in the commissioner's office. So that's what he did. And I went through that interview process. I met Frank Cash in there. And then I contacted Harry out in Milwaukee, asked him for an opportunity, and I had my coaches give him a call and recommend me. Bill Thurston was a baseball coach, and Austin Darp was a football coach, and Austin Darp was from Baltimore, so he knew Harry Dalton. So he called and recommended me, and then Bob Brown worked with Frank Cash in Baltimore, and Frank went from the commissioner's office to the Mets. And so Bob Brown got me an interview with Frank Cash and with the Mets in spring training. I went down there for the spring trip with the Amherst College baseball team, and I met with Frank during a game in St. Petersburg and interviewed with him. And then when I got back from Florida, Harry Dalton invited me in for an interview when the Brewers came to Yankee Stadium. So that was a big thrill for me to go down to Yankee Stadium, meet the Brewers general manager. Sent me down on the field and let me watch the Yankees take batting practice. Pinella and Jackson were hitting that day. That was a big thrill for me. And then Harry offered me a job to get started with the Brewers. He said, I'll take you in, I can start you July the 1st. When are you graduating? I said, oh, May 20th. He goes, all right, I can start you July the 1st. And then Harry gave me an opportunity to go to work for him in Milwaukee, you know, which was a terrific training ground. Bud Selig was the owner of the club, and Harry was the GM, and Harry told me that he would give me the same training that he got when he started with the Orioles. I think Harry started in, Harry graduated in 1950. I think he started with the Orioles maybe 1954. I think that's when the Orioles came to Baltimore from St. Louis. He said, I'll give you the same training that we used in Baltimore to build a good team. And so that's how I got started.
You mentioned Bill Thurston. You, Neil Huntington, and Ben Cherington all played for him. What are the odds that three major league GMs would come from the same college program and come from the same coach?
Well, Bill Thurston was there for, what, 45 years?
Right. Well, he didn't play together, the three of you, but...
Right, right. And he's a really conservative grader, right? He doesn't recommend anybody unless they're top shelf. And he recommended me to Harry Dalton, and I knew that he was very conservative because Harry wanted me to start my career as a backup catcher for a rookie team. So he called up Thurston. He said, hey, Bill, this is what I have in mind for Dan Duquette. He goes, I want him to be the third catcher on our team in Butte, Montana, in the Pioneer League. So I want him to have the experience of going out and being with a minor league team. And it'll be easier for me administratively and on my budget if I start him as a minor league player than bring him into the office in the fall for the new fiscal year. And he goes, Bill, what do you think of that? He goes, oh, no, Harry, that'll never work.
He's honest, right?
And Harry said, hey, Bill, you know, I really want this kid. He plays ball for you. He goes, I really want this kid to have the on-field experience, he said, because my whole career people said, you know, that guy doesn't know anything. He doesn't have any field experience. He goes, I want Dan to have that opportunity. Thurston says, no, Harry, that'll never work. So anyway, when he called to recommend Neil Huntington to me when I was in Montreal, I knew that he wasn't calling for nothing, right?
Right.
Because he's only going to recommend a guy to you if he is really passionate about baseball and he believes he'll make a career out of it. So Bill calls me up and he says, hey, Danny, so the leading hitter on our team is this kid named Neil Huntington. And Neil Huntington is about a 400 lifetime hitter. He goes, but he's a first baseman. He's not very tall. And I don't think he's a pro prospect. He goes, but his father is a farmer and he grew up on a farm. And he's a very industrious kid and he loves baseball. He goes, I'd recommend you give him a shot. He goes, I think you'll be a general manager.
Pretty good eye for talent there.
I said, fair enough. So I recommended him to the Expos, and Bill Stoneman brought him on, and Neil went to work for us. And, you know, fast forward a couple years later, I went to Boston. And he goes, calls me up again. He goes, Dan, I got this kid also from New Hampshire. He goes, he's a baseball rat. He's got great instincts. And he's about the best kid I've had. And he probably has the best instincts. He goes, I think he'll be the best executive that I've ever recommended. I said, who's that, Bill? He goes, it's Ben Charrington. He goes, he's a pitcher on the team. He hurt his shoulder, he has to rehab, he went into coaching with us. He's very passionate about baseball, he knows a lot about baseball, he knows pitching. He goes, you should give him a shot. I said, okay, I said, I'll hire him as an intern. And he can come to work, so he came to work during the interim. And then, you know, Ben goes on, he wins the World Series for the Red Sox. Pretty good recommendations, right?
I was going to say, after the first one, you said, all right, well, I'll listen this time. So he's
But the Emers legacy really started with Harry Dalton, right? He gave me an opportunity, and
he didn't play for Bill, right?
I mean, Emers does a pretty good job pre-selecting talent, right? I mean, it's a very selective school, and it's a really good proving ground. But a lot of the graduates will go into medicine or law. But, in our case, we like baseball. We like the program. We got some good training. And Harry gave me a shot, and I gave Neil and Ben a shot. Those guys worked their way up to become really good executives.
When you were in Montreal, the talent you drafted and acquired there at the Expos, in the early 90s, you look at that register, it's like an all-star team. Do you ever wonder what the 94 Expos might have accomplished if not for the strike?
Yeah, that was tough. That was tough on the whole city. But we had a terrific player development operation. So I think we had the best record in baseball that year. We had the most wins, and we also had the lowest payroll. So we were at the low end of the payroll, but we were at the high end of the talent scale. And the only way you can do that, of course, is have a great player development operation, and that's what the Expos had.
Do you think it might have changed the course of baseball in Montreal if that year had played?
Well, that's possible. The club had to put a lot of those players on sale the next year, given the conditions of the strike. in order to survive. You know, it would have been interesting to see if the club could have survived in Montreal with a World Series championship. But I think the club was 74-40 at the time of the strike, on pace to win like 107 games. So Buck was with the Yankees that year, right? And Buck's Yankees, I think, were in first place. And of course, Buck thinks the Yankees would have won the pennant and the World Series.
That's surprising.
But, you know, it doesn't matter. It's, you know, I have a ball at home, 1994 World Series ball, right? Of course, that's a collector's item.
Right.
There was no 1994 World Series. So
it's like those people who have Buffalo Bills Super Bowl champion shirts,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so we can speculate and discuss it, but I have seen some computer profiles that have run the series, Expos, Yankees, and the computers have said that the National League team prevailed that year, but
well, there you have it.
It didn't happen.
As a guy who grew up in Massachusetts, what was it like to get the Red Sox GM job?
Well, and if you grow up in Massachusetts or you grow up in New England, you know, the Red Sox have this certain stature, and it's important to the people of New England. The you know, my uncle, Father Don Bosco, who's a parish priest, he said that, you know, it's part of the geographical lore of New England, you know, that you follow the Red Sox. And he went so far as to say, I think it's even in the mother's milk there, that the affinity for the Red Sox gets passed down from generation to generation. So I always followed the Red Sox. They were the team of choice of my grandfathers, my grandmothers. We used to go out to my grandmother's for root beer floats, and she'd be sitting there in front of the TV watching the Red Sox, and she'd come out and she'd get us our, you know, root beer floats, but she'd go right back in there and sit down and watch the Red Sox, and we'd watch the games with her religiously.
Sure.
And that's the way it is in New England. I mean, the people in New England follow the Red Sox, and the people around the Red Sox, I mean, they know what you have for breakfast, for crying out loud. They're so passionate about it, and it's just a great area, you know, if you want to be a baseball fan.
So how many friends family members must have found you at that point?
You know, the thing about that is, that's great. Everybody wants to be involved. But it seems like the family always wanted to come to the Yankee games.
What a shock.
They always wanted to come to the playoff games.
Yeah, well, covering the Yankees for the last 16 years, yeah. It was the same thing. Yeah. Red Sox were in town, all of a sudden, hey, can you help me get tickets for this?
Yeah. Don't, you know, why didn't you call me when Cleveland was in
town?
That's
right.
You know, but anyway, that was a lot of fun. The 99 All-Star game, that was a terrific thrill. You know, my family was there at the game, and we had several generations of our family that followed the Red Sox. So that was a nice thing. And then when the Red Sox finally won the World Series, and our families got to see it, right?
Right.
A lot of people said they could die then, right? Or at least they could. I can die now. I can die happy. The Red Sox won the World Series.
Mentioning that 99 year, the Red Sox and Yankees played in the postseason that year for the first time ever with the new rules. Given the nature of that rivalry, what was it like, that first Yankees-Red Sox postseason meeting?
Well, I mean, that was that was something that, you know, I dreamed about, you know, going for the pennant. You know, the Red Sox for years had to get by the Yankees, and, you know, that's pretty formidable. Challenge. You know, the Yankees had won all those championships, but a lot of times the Red Sox were the second best team in baseball when the Yankees had gone on to win. 78 was a good example. So I mean that was a lot of fun. I think we lost the first game and the second game in extra innings, so that put us behind the eight ball. We were able to win a game with. I think Pedro Martinez beat Clemens.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a big thrill. But, you know, the real thrill was when the Red Sox broke through and actually beat the Yankees a couple years later. You know, it was nice to play the Yankees in the playoffs, but, you know, it was really nice to beat him. And, you know, the Red Sox got that turned around when Veritek punched A-Rod in the mouth and said, "We're not taking it anymore. We're going to go and we're going to win the championship." That was like knocking out the heavyweight champ.
I was there that day. That was an interesting day.
Yeah. But I think that's when the Red Sox really decided they were going to win the World Series. And, you know, of course, they had the opportunity there in 03 where they thought they were going to win it, but unfortunately didn't. And the Red Sox came back the following year and did it.
Sports Illustrated once called you, quote, cold-blooded for your decision to let Roger Clemens leave Boston. Is it imperative for a GM to not let nostalgia get in the way when it comes to making baseball decisions? Not even that one specifically, but just in general.
The thing is like, you know, if you're in a, you know, you're running a personnel operation, you've got to make objective decisions for the club. And you're always torn between the, you know, your personal feelings and what's good for the club. And you go back and forth. You know, none of these... not too many of the personnel decisions are black and white. Most of them are gray. And, you know, you got to try to do the best you can, you know, with the information that you have.
I know when Bernie Williams almost signed with the Red Sox, everybody in New York was saying, well, how could he sign with the Red Sox? But players have the same, you know, people say that, you know, executives are cold blooded for letting somebody go, but players have no problem jumping from one side of a rivalry to another either.
Well, remember when Johnny Damon signed... played with the Red Sox. He had 4 good years.
Helped break the curse.
And the following year, he signed with the Yankees. And the shirts in Boston was let's see. Looks like Jesus. Acts like Judas, throws like Mary.
Yeah. That's exactly the shirt.
Right.
I believe I have several of my Boston University alum friends who wore that shirt.
Right. So, I mean, that explains the emotions of the fan base, you know, towards players, you know, when they leave from one club to another. But I don't begrudge the players for, you know, going where their, you know, their best opportunities are, or whatever they perceive their best opportunities to be.
You stayed at baseball for 9 years before coming back with the Orioles. Was there a point during that time when you thought your career as a baseball executive was over for good?
No, I thought I would get another opportunity. I stayed active in youth baseball with my sports academy, and we had a summer college team in the NECBL, and there was a lot of players going from there into pro ball, and helping found the Israel Baseball League. I stayed active with in the international recruiting venue. So I thought I would get another opportunity, and then after my kids got out of high school and went to college, that's when I started looking for, in earnest, for another serious opportunity in baseball. Unfortunately, I got a shot with the Orioles. Mr. Angelos gave me an opportunity to work with Buck, and, you know, I'm grateful for that.
If you're enjoying this Mark Feinsand interview, make sure you check out all the great conversations featured in the MLB.com Newsmakers podcast. You'll hear Mark and other MLB.com reporters chat with baseball's brightest stars of today and the past, as well as the game's best broadcasters and writers. You can download MLB.com Newsmakers today on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts by searching Newsmakers. Now, back to Mark Feinsand.
Given that history as director of baseball operations for the Israel Baseball League, it's been fun for you to watch Team Israel go through this run in the WBC.
Yeah, the boys are doing pretty good.
Right.
And, you know, we were trying to promote the candidacy of the Israel for the World Baseball Classic, and that was one of the goals of the league, was to get Israel into the WBC. You know, eventually we accomplished it. And then this year's team has done really well. Jerry Weinstein's done a great job. And Peter Kurz was involved in the federation. He's the head of the IAB, and a lot of the players that have played in the Israel Baseball League have been the big support system, and a lot of the impetus behind the club doing well. So that's great. I'm glad to see them doing well.
Even though you left the Red Sox in 2002, you mentioned the 2004. You said it was fun to watch them win in 2004. Any mixed emotions as you're watching that, given that you were responsible for bringing in so many players that that ultimately helped them break that curse?
I mean, it would have been nice to be with the team, but it didn't work out that way. But I was glad for the players that were the core players on that team, that they got an opportunity to be part of that group to win the World Series. And, you know, almost three quarters of the contribution to that club came from players that we signed. So the fans recognized that. And it was a great thrill to see Pedro and Derek Lowe pitch really good games to clinch the World Series in St. Louis.
After being hired by the Orioles in November 2011, you helped guide the team back to the postseason for the first time since 1997. How satisfying was it to have such immediate results?
Well, the Orioles are a great franchise. They had stumbled on some rough times, and I was glad to help them get back in the playoffs. The fans just wanted some hope, and we gave them some hope. That was a fun year. We did all the statues for the living Hall of Famers. Well, they were all living then, but we put statues and we turned the team around at the same time. It was kind of a magical season for the Orioles. We've been able to get to the playoffs, three times in the last 5 years, so we've established a winning tradition with the club, and, you know, now we need to follow through and, you know, give them a championship tradition.
No, hindsight's 20/20, so you had no way of knowing that Jake Arrieta would turn into the pitcher that he has. Do you ever second-guess yourself on trades? How long do you wait to sort of evaluate how a trade worked out?
Well, you know, some of the trades you make work out, some of them don't work out. For whatever reason, Jake hadn't been able to, you know, find his groove in Baltimore. He had a lot of chances. And, you know, he did well when he went to the Cubs. You know, sometimes they work out, sometimes they don't. But, you know, we try to have a system that we rely on so that we make out the ones that work out.
You've been on the other side of that, too. The Pedro deal worked out pretty well for you.
Well, we've had our share of good deals. You know, it's like you just got to do the best you can. Sometimes you don't have all the information to make a trade like you should, and sometimes you have all the information you make, and the due diligence works out in your favor.
The Blue Jays' interest in you in 2015 was very public, as was the Nationals' interest last year. Is that a difficult situation for you when you're still trying to accomplish your goals and do your job here and that stuff is out there?
Well, I just try to focus on helping the Orioles and the team. You know, I've been able to develop an effective track record as an executive over the years, and you know, that's helped me, you know, have a good livelihood in Major League Baseball.
2 years back, some teams were looked at as more analytic heavy. Some teams were looked at as more scouting heavy. Now all 30 teams have analytics departments to some degree. Do you think now it's teams look at it more as a just fitting the puzzle pieces together, or do you think there are still some teams that you know, rely more heavily on analytics than scouting?
Well, I'm sure that teams have their own system, but the technology has made the measuring tools for talent to be more precise. And you know, the clubs that are able to identify that exploit that, you know, they seem to be pretty good every year.
One of those technologies, MLB StatCast, is now widely available to the public. Do you think that's changing the way fans are looking at the game?
Well, I think it's great. It gives the fans another hook to identify with the players, to get involved with the players, and, you know, to know how extraordinary the skills are of these players. I mean, yeah, look at that kid, Chapman, the closer for the Cubs.
Yankees now.
The Yankees, he's back with the Yankees.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy is a total freak. And I mean, freak.
It's the only word.
In that he's unique.
Yeah.
Right? And here's a guy that releases the ball closer to home plate than I think anybody else in the history and throws the ball harder. So it's like, how do you hit a ball that's coming at you that fast from a guy that gets that kind of extension and he's that close? I don't know how you do it. It's just extraordinary.
How do you think how have your views or philosophies on the game changed most from the beginning of your career to now?
Well, I mean, baseball is a great game. It has its challenges. We have a lot of challenges for baseball, making it accessible and easy to play, because it's hard to play baseball. It's hard to pitch and throw. That's an unnatural act, and then stay healthy. And it's really hard to hit. I mean, hitting is hard. So we have this challenge because our game's so hard and the players so highly skilled. You know, how do you distribute it to young kids to play it? Because it takes a while to see if you have the skills to learn how to play it well. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge that baseball has. You know, how do you make it accessible? How do you process young players effectively so that they enjoy the game? I mean, if you play the game and you have an affinity for it, then you can be a fan for a long time. But it's really hard to play. I mean, there's other sports that are a lot easier to play, you know, with rounder balls that are bigger, easier to catch, and, you know, there's a lot of body movements that are easier to do than, you know, throwing a ball or hitting a ball. So I think that's the big challenge for baseball.
The media landscape is so different today than it was when you first started, obviously, as a GM, and even when you were in Boston. How does that impact your job?
Well, I think that it makes it easier to communicate with fans directly, and it's easier to get your message out, you know, more direct and communicate with the constituents of the team. So I think it's great, and it's also helped make the baseball accessible to more people worldwide.
So much was made of Buck's decision not to use Britton in last year's wildcard game. Not going to revisit that, but when you watch Francona, the way he used Andrew Miller in the postseason and the success they had, and even the way he used him in the regular season, do you think managers may begin using their bullpens differently going forward, having seen some of that? Or is that just a situation where when the postseason you have extra days off, it's easier to do then?
Well, I think in the case of the postseason, when you have the extra days off, you can get your best pitchers out there more consistently, and I think that's what the clubs in the postseason did effectively last year. I think the Indians had like 11 off days last year during their playoff run, and they managed their pitching effectively to leverage their best pitchers out there, and you know, they almost ended up winning the pennant. Or they won the pennant, they almost ended up winning the World Series. So I think that the schedule makes it easier to bring back your pitchers, and they're rested when you get them out there.
Were you surprised that the Britton thing got so much coverage?
Yeah, I mean that was a tough one. It was a tough one for the Orioles and the team. You know, given that it was a one game deal. So that one game playoff puts a lot of pressure and puts a lot of focus on it. And, you know, it'd be easier for the teams if you had another shot other than your elimination game on the first one. But I think, you know, that probably the play-in game is what makes it attractive to fans. And, you know, when you lose that playoff game, it makes for a long off season. In 2012, we were on the other side of the coin. We beat the Texas Rangers in a one-game playoff. And we were able to advance, but one game puts a lot of focus on things that people wouldn't normally see or focus on. It puts a lot of stress on the team to win that game.
Do you think setup relievers are being given more credit than they maybe ever have been before? You've seen them selected all-star teams, guys like Andrew Miller, Brad Brock, getting recognition that really hasn't been there very often in the past.
Well, those guys,
and contracts.
Yeah, I mean, those guys are making money, but they're earning it. They're earning it. You saw the value of the really good relievers in the playoffs. You know, those guys are helping their team win games.
Baltimore's been such a great baseball town for such a long time. 14 straight losing seasons and 6 straight years of 90-plus losses before you got here. How satisfying has it been for you to see the fan base get so excited about the Orioles again?
Well, the fan base came back in 2012. We had a rain delay before the start of the first game, and Jim Johnson had been there for a long time, and he was the player rep. And one of the other players asked him, do you think the fans are going to stay He said, well, they've been waiting for 14 years. I'm pretty sure they're going to stay. So when we started the game, they were a big asset. And, you know, it's good to see the fans come out and support the Orioles. It's a great baseball town. And the community has supported us. They've watched our games on the TV. They like our players. You know, they like Manny, of course. Zach Britton, Adam Jones. I mean, these guys are really passionate players. And the fans have connected with them. And, you know, it's been a nice match.
You expressed no interest in Jose Bautista this winter. Quoted as saying, and I quote, Jose is a villain in Baltimore, and I'm not going to tell our fans that we're courting Jose Bautista for the Orioles because they're not going to be happy. a lot of people were surprised to read that quote. How often do you consider something like fan reaction when thinking about potential?
Well, that was an easy one, right? Our fans just don't like Jose. We play those guys 25 times a year, and he's the face of the Blue Jays. So, you know, he's the villain in the play whenever we play the Blue Jays. You know, but I mean, I like our guys. Our guys are good. Like, Trumbo is like a working class type baseball player. You know, if he was going to work every day on a construction site, you know, you would understand it. He brings that kind of work ethic every day, and that's the kind of player that our fans identify with. We try to get gritty players that work hard every day and, you know, give their best effort every day. You know, our fans seem to like that and respond to it.
So it's safe to say it's a rare occasion when something like that comes into play. I mean, I remember the Yankees almost signed Albert Bell once, and that was a guy Yankee fans couldn't stand.
Yeah, well, they didn't have to watch Albert Bell. They re-signed Bernie Williams, right?
That's right.
So, I don't know. I think there's a certain type player that our players appreciate. You know, they've come out and supported the guys we got.
Adam Jones has been one of the faces of your franchise for several years. How important is he to this team, both on and off the field?
Well, Adam's been great. He lives in the community. He's an excellent role model. He's involved in the middle of our lineup. He's involved in the center of our defense, and he's a central man in our community. So it's been fun working with Adam over the last couple of years. He established a home there. Married a girl from Baltimore, and you know, he's had a really good run.
What's it like watching Manny Machado play on a daily basis?
Well, that to me is a great throw. And I don't know that I could give him any higher praise than what Brooks Robinson gave him when he said, I would pay money to see Manny Machado play. I don't know what other compliment I could give Manny that would be higher than that.
Speaking of paying money and Manny, I asked Mike Rizzo this question in regards to Bryce Harper. Manny's going to be a free agent in 2 years. Do you think about that a lot? Do you think about this being a window? Do you think about trying to extend him? I mean, when you have a player of that magnitude who's getting closer to free agency, how much does that factor into your head when you're thinking about decisions with the team?
Well, Manny's a great player. He's a really gifted player, so I enjoy watching him play every day. You know, some of the long-term decisions that the franchise has, you know, the franchise will have to contend with the Manny's free agency, but I'm not sure we have to do that right now. But we certainly have to think about it.
Season a few weeks away still, what would you say right now is the Orioles' biggest strength and their biggest question mark?
I would say our biggest strength is our bullpen. And the biggest strength for any club this time of year is the health of your starting pitchers.
And question mark.
Yeah, going into the season, you know. You see the teams that do well every year. You look at the health of their five starting pitchers going into spring training, that a lot of time that determines kind of year you have.
Lastly, what's your assessment right now of the state of the American League East?
You know, the American League East, that's a tough neighborhood, right? You've got to be ready to play ball day in and day out in the American League East, and you need to play a complete game to win that day's game, right? These other clubs, they got a lot more resources than the Orioles have, but fortunately, we've been able to compete very effectively against them for the last 5 years, and we're going to do our best to do the same thing this year.
And thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
All right.